Good morning, everyone. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Africa Program here. And thanks for joining us for this update on how the ongoing efforts to eradicate the Lord's Resistance Army are progressing. And also for a wider discussion, I hope, this morning on how those efforts are playing out in the Central African region. As you'll know, President Obama announced last October that the United States was sending up to 100 military advisors and support staff to assist in regional efforts to eradicate the LRA. This was probably the most eye-catching initiative yet to emerge from the administration as it responded to a congressional mandate to come up with a broad strategy for putting an end to this brutal group, which has plagued not only Uganda but a much wider swathe of Central Africa for near on 25 years now. The announcement by President Obama was welcomed by many, particularly the very active advocacy community, which has worked so hard to bring this issue to the attention of Congress and the wider public, and glad to see some representatives from these groups here this morning. But it's also been interesting, though, since October, to observe some of the unease that's been expressed about the U.S. deployment, particularly given its relatively small size, the fact that U.S. troops aren't going to be doing any of the fighting, and the almost universal agreement that getting rid of the LRA is a laudable objective. So why this sense of unease? Well, in Congress, despite tasking the president to come up with a plan to deal with the LRA, there have been some voices expressing their doubts about the operation, wondering whether it justifies the risk and obviously the expense. In Africa, there's been a proliferation of conspiracy theories about whether this operation is in fact a cover for something more sinister, an attempt to get U.S. hands on Ugandan's oil or to counter Chinese influence on the continent. There's also, though, the rather more legitimate concern of whether this deployment plays into the hands of the Ugandan president, for example, Museveni, who's becoming a more and more powerful actor in the region at the same time as he cracks down on dissent at home. Finally, of course, there's the unease about achieving what is really a very difficult military objective. As we know, previous attempts to remove Joseph Kony and his followers from the battlefield have not gone according to plan. In fact, they've had pretty disastrous consequences for civilians in this region. So we're going to address some of these questions and concerns this morning with three speakers with a really in-depth knowledge of what's going on and also with some different viewpoints to offer as well. We're going to start this morning with Ledio Kakaj, who's an independent researcher focusing on armed groups and security sector reform. Has worked exclusively almost on the LRA for the past 3 years, traveled extensively in the region very recently as well, so we're looking forward to hearing his remarks. We're going to follow that with Joel Barkin, who's a senior associate here at CSIS with our program, also a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Iowa, long-time expert on governance issues in Africa, particularly Kenya and Uganda, so we look forward to hearing from him as well. And finally, really pleased to be joined by Carl Wyckoff, who's Deputy Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the Department of State, where he has overall responsibility for the set of countries affected by the LRA and some more besides, and has been working extensively on LRA issues for Department of State. So without further ado, let's start things off. Ledio, over to you. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me here. It's such a pleasure being here, particularly with such distinguished guest speakers. But I've worked with Ambassador Wyckoff on the International Working Group with the LRA, and Professor Bargan is a friend. So thanks, Richard, for organizing this. I want to state for the record that before we start, that I'm not particularly uneasy about the deployment of the U.S. advisors. I think it was a great it was a good step. It was a culmination of an amazing advocacy campaign by organizations based here in Washington, as well as in the region in Africa and Europe. And it generated a lot of interest on the LRA topic, on the LRA conflict that has not been there before. So just to start with. I'm not quite sure about the level of knowledge about the LRA at the moment. I've been told to sort of do a general overview of what's happening with the LRA groups, with the military offensive, both the UPDF and the U.S. advisors. And so I'm going to do an overview, and then I'm going to talk about a few concerns that I have with the operation in general, as well as strategy, and sort of end on a note of addressing some what I like to call unquestioned assumptions. We have a map here to sort of indicate some of the areas. I apologize for the quality. It might not be great. I will attempt to sort of point it with a laser, but I might get it completely wrong because I cannot quite see very well. I apologize for that. I'm always happy to talk about these places, some of these remote areas. If somebody has questions afterwards, I'm always happy to talk about that. So I'd like to start with sort of the composition of the LRA, their groups, where they're located, and sort of the kind of the command status. And I'd like to say for the record that I've also, most of my numbers come directly from interviews with former combatants, both in all those areas in Uganda, Congo, South Sudan, and CAR. So at the moment, the LRA, or rather the LRA groups, are split in two sort of major groups, although even these big groups tend to break down into smaller groups, particularly to increase mobility and to evade hunting UPDF units. At the moment, the majority of the LRA are based in CAR, in Bomo and Ombomo prefecture, or rather in CAR. Now this doesn't work, of course. Can you mess with this?
Excuse me, would it be possible to move that podium back because the view is completely blocked?
Sure.
Here, let me take it.
Is that any better?
That's getting there.
There we go.
All right, good.
Oh, so now I can't.
No, you can't see.
Anyway, I'll just know. It's fine. No, it's all right. I don't want to sort of stand up and. It's fine. So, the majority of the LRA numbers, about 250 combatants. That is a sort of the hardcore trained LRA, mostly Ugandans, are based in one area called the Zemongo, the Zemongo, a forested area. The locals know it as the Ochinko, after the river, River Shinko, which starts from the border with Congo, from Mbomo River, and goes all the way up into southern Sudan in Raja County. Zemongo is in many ways very similar to Garamba National Park, where the LRA was based. End of 2005 to 2008, when they eventually left due to the UPDF attack of December 14, 2008, lightning thunder. It is based on testimony from SKPs, people who recently left the LRA. The setup in Zemongo is also sort of similar to Garamba, where there are three or four different camps, LRA. These are all mobile camps. In other words, they move. But there are at least two or three who complete with cultivated fields as well as defensive positions, which indicates a level of settlement or settling that we have not seen at least since December 2008 when they were in Congo. It appears that Kony and his top commanders, particularly the ICC indictees, Okoto Diambo, as well as Dominique Ongwen, surprisingly, has joined him, as well as the third in command, Cesar Achalam. They're all based in and around CAR. At least that's what we think based on a testimony from former combatants. There is a lot of movement of LRA groups or small groups from Zemongo, from Ochinko, into southern Darfur or areas around southern Darfur, particularly Kafia Kingi, which is an area that is still disputed between the south and the north, right next to CAR, right actually next to Zemongo. One of the great advantages of Zemongo is that it sort of starts closer to the Congolese border and then it ends right on the Sudanese border and continues a little bit into Sudan. And the river that transcends it, it's a great way for LRA to move. It's traditionally LRA groups move alongside rivers, precisely because they can identify it on the map, and it offers food like and water while during the trip. I have spoken to at least 8 or 9 former combatants who gave me a testimony of at least 2 different meetings or 2 different forays into southern Darfur near the town of Buram, and meeting with SAF elements, the Sudanese Armed Forces. So that is the Khartoum-controlled military, both in 2009 and 2010. There could have been a meeting recently or in 2011. I don't have any evidence to support that. At the same time, there has been no evidence that the SAF or Khartoum has resumed supplying the LRA like they used to with arms and logistics until 2005. The other largish group of the LRA is based in Congo. This is the most active group. They are the ones that commit attacks pretty much on a daily basis. They are based in and around Garamba, about 50 of them. So I think altogether, I know this question will come up later, my numbers suggest to be about 300 LRA combatants, most of them well-trained, well-disciplined, not including, obviously, women and children, and not including recent abductees, so Congolese, Central Africans, and Sudanese. The Congo groups tend to split into much smaller groups. They also sometimes have gone down to 2 or 3 groups. And what has been really worrying is that there has been a resurgence of LRA attacks in areas that were for a while in 2011 either free of LRA attacks or had witnessed sporadic attacks. So particularly Bangadi, Ngilima, and Dungu, the so-called Triangle of Death, there's been a resurgence of attacks there. But also around Jabir, which is near Faraje, and a little bit in Aba, which is near Sudanese Congo, Sudanese border. So in many ways, we are back at where we were sort of right after December 2008. LRA was based in Bazwele for a while, which is further west in Congo. It appeared they cleared out of there. But then again, I heard, I think recently in December, there was another attack there, or at least a witnessing of LRA group. That's possible, and then also there was an attack in Barua in CAR, which is on the way from Bazwele. So right there. Barua, I believe, is right there, I'm guessing here. And I think that's because there is some movement of LRA groups from Bazwele to CAR, again, following the rivers most likely, or the Mbororo cattle, like herder, like the Mororo paths, the nomadic groups, the pastoralist groups. So to conclude on the LRA, one could say that yes, the LRA is weakened in the last 3 years since December 2008, but I wouldn't say that they're necessarily weak. If you look into the history of the LRA in the past 15, 20 years, even at peak strength, even when they had like biggest numbers, particularly in early 2000, right before Operation Iron Fist, they had 3,000, 4,000, I don't know, numbers varied. But when it came down to sort of the hardcore group, the nucleus of the LRA, the fully radicalized one, the well-trained ones, you didn't have more than about 500. While people could hold a gun or sort of be around or maybe in the thousands. So even though we're talking about a small group of 300 or 400, they are certainly a force multiplier. They certainly can commit attacks and violence that is disproportionately large to their numbers. And the point that has been made in the past, particularly in the LRA diagnostic study that the World Bank commissioned for the International Working Group on the LRA, it's that the LRA only has to survive to succeed. That's, I think, key to this. Then, as long as there will be LRA left, the world is going to talk about the problem of the LRA. whether that's Kony or not, and we can talk about that later because I know that people like to ask about whether Kony is crucial to the LRA, and I have my thoughts on that. I'm going to quickly move to the UPDF, the Ugandan Army, and what they've been doing for a while. I have interviewed a lot of Ugandan Army officers. Many of them already left, a lot of Ugandan Army soldiers as well, and a lot of former LRA who are now fighting for the Ugandan Army. So sort of most of my information comes pretty much from talking to people that are in the Ugandan Army. My numbers might be slightly off. I haven't, at least my numbers, I think, would be more or less updated until December of 2011. But I believe, and I might be wrong on this, that the UPDF has no more than about 1,000, 1,200 troops deployed to the LRA front. That would include logistics and other personnel. So in other words, not all 1,200 go after LRA groups. Perhaps, I'm not a military person, but 600 to 800 maybe are into deployed into units to chase after LRA groups. There are about, I think, 400 former LRA combatants in that 600 that fight. Some of them are ones that have come out early, in other words, before 2008. But about 200 of them, 250, have come out after 2008, so after Operation Lightning Thunder. And it appears that they're doing most of the fighting. And it appears that also at least 200 of them are divided into groups that are only former LRA, that are commanded by former LRA commanders. So some of these former LRA combatants are told are not reintegrated in the Ugandan army. They are not trained. They don't receive any payment. So some legal and some moral issues there that I have touched upon, at least on one of my reports for Enough, called Too Far From Home. The UPDF is based, it has headquarters in Zara in South Sudan, about 20 kilometers north of Yambio, the capital of Western Equatoria State. And then in CAR, it has bases in Obo, which is right at the triangle, right at the corner of CAR, Sudan, and Congo, in the southeastern, sort of most further corner of CAR. And they also have sort of tactical forward operating bases in Jema, which is right in the corner of Zamongo, so very much where the LRA, or very close to where the LRA are now, as well as in Derbisaka, which is on the way, it's right north of Barua, so on the way from Bazwele to CAR. And Zemio is in between. In terms of results of the UPDF offensive that started in 2008, as I said, called Operation Lightning Thunder, where the U.S. played a part with sending some advisors and providing money, logistics, and fuel. I think that the offensive has stalled, at least in terms of real results, in terms of commanders caught or captured or killed. The last commander that we know of that was killed, a top-level commander, was Boka Budema, who was killed in 31st of December 2009, not very far from Jema, by the Ugandan forces. It's one of the only times where the Ugandan army did what I think one would require militarily to do to deal with the LRA, which is to get information and act quickly upon that information. And that's what happened when Abudema was killed. We'll get into it later, but pretty much it meant they learned that the LRA was attacking Jema and got there a day before the LRA was about to attack, and foiled the attack and eventually killed the top commander. There hasn't been any of that since. And I don't know if that's a real an issue with numbers. I think that there were about 5,000 UPDF troops when the operation started. It's hard to know because we were never told, we meet the researchers. So, but there's certainly been a withdrawal of troops. Even though I'd like to say that with the deployment of U.S. advisors, there has certainly been more interest in Kampala, and I'm not sure whether that has translated in more troops, more Ugandan troops. I certainly hope so. There are, however, many concerns about the UPDF behavior, or at least the individual soldiers, and I'm going to get into that a little bit towards the sort of the end of my talk here. But I was in Bangui in December of 2011 and spoke to people there who had presence in the field, NGOs and local and international. as well as government officials. And when I was in Oboe and Boki and Jema in March of 2010, I found that there was definitely a sort of a welcome extended to the Ugandans by the local population. People seem to be happy that finally they had somebody to protect them against the LRA, because the FAKA, the local forces, are not, don't have the capacity, don't have the, perhaps even the willingness, don't have the numbers to deal with the LRA. And in general, there was a very good UPDF behavior, including using their military hospital to cure people, to treat people. I haven't been to Oboe yet, but the feeling that I haven't been to Oboe in December or until now, but the feeling that I got from Bangui is that it appears that the UPDF has worn out their welcome in these areas for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, individual behavior, including public drunkenness, soliciting prostitution, particularly some disturbing cases of Congolese girls of 12 years old from Congolese refugee camps. And then some cases of trade, bringing things from Uganda and selling them there, particularly alcohol, and giving them to women. And some very concerning allegations about timber, illicit use of timber in Oboe. I was told that one forest in Oboe has been destroyed because the UPDF has been cutting down the timber. And that's very concerning because there are echoes there from Ugandan behavior post-Operation Iron Thunder. Iron Fist in 2002 in Sudan, where there was some research done to indicate that the Ugandan army used illicitly timber from Sudan. I haven't been able to verify these claims, but I've seen a report from an official from Oboe, which pretty much details that all of these allegations. Those are certainly concerns, but it appears that it's not endemic. It seems to be still at individual level, although there are some concerns about the sort of impunity in the UPDF. I'm going to quickly talk about the U.S. advisors, although I am certainly not an expert. I don't know what's happened too much with the U.S. advisors. There is certainly some operational secrecy at place. A colleague, friend of mine, a journalist, was in Oboe and said that he was surprised at the level of hostility shown by the Americans, who told him to just get out. But I think that things have changed now and it's been a little bit better. But I hope that Ambassador Wyckoff will be able to talk a little bit more about that. My understanding is there are 30 U.S. advisors, or at least there should be about 30, settled in Oboe, and the rest are based in Entebbe and Nzara. I believe there are two U.S. analysts working at the Joint Intelligence Center in Dungu in Congo, which is great because that unit needed some good intelligence gathering and analysis. I saw in a paper today or yesterday that a U.S. official said that there are troops in Congo. I suppose that meant the two intelligence analysts, because as far as I understand, the UPDF is not allowed to enter Congo. It hasn't been allowed to enter Congo for a while, and I'm going to get into that in a second, because that's a major concern, because obviously we have a LRA group active in Congo. The only active group is in Congo at the moment. Unclear what the U.S. advisors are doing in Oboe at the moment. I hope they're going to go to Jema soon. Obviously, that's closest to where the LRA are at the moment. I'm not sure if they're going out on patrols with the Ugandan army, and I believe they should. It would be very important for us to know not only what the LRA modus operandi is, but most importantly, what the UPDF modus operandi is. Why is it that they haven't been able to do this for a while? However, I'd like to finish on the point of the U.S. advisors that, whether intentionally or not, there are very high expectations now in the field, I believe to a certain extent here as well, that this is all done. I mean, the CONI will be captured any minute now. Now that the Americans are there, you know, there's a lot of people that watch Rambo movies and expect the U.S. soldiers to come and do miracles. I don't know. I met some of these U.S. advisors. They seem very serious. They're pretty huge also, so that helps. the high expectations thing, I think it's something that I guess need to be tempered a little bit or managed better, I guess. So I just want to get quickly to the point that I just made about the sort of role of advisors. I started this by saying, let me know if I get over time. Yeah. Okay, so I'll talk now very fast. So as I said, when I started this, I think that the advisors being there, it's a good thing. It generated a lot of interest. It brought attention to not only the LRA issue, but also the UPDF, what they've been doing for the last 25 years, and what is wrong? What is it that we need to do to help them? Or is that even an issue anymore? Can and should we help them anymore? We, meaning the U.S. I'm not American, so I apologize for that. As I said, the best one of the best roles for the advisors, as I said, is to understand the MO of the LRA, but also UPDF, and most importantly, to try and curb any potential abuses by the UPDF on the field. More eyes on the field, particularly when there are U.S. or international observers, is the better for at least for the local population, as well as for the LRA cause in general that gets more attention. But beyond that, I'm not sure what the value added of the advisors is exactly. As I said, a lot of people seem to think that Kony is going to be dealt soon. Some of them, also U.S. officials, have publicly said, have expressed a lot of optimism. I'm not sure that I share that optimism, although I want to, precisely because I think the sophisticated technology, thermal heat cameras, satellite imagery, all that stuff is great. I think it's good. I'm not necessarily sure that it's very effective when it comes to the LRA. Here we have a group that are very good at hiding, very good at operating in very difficult terrain, at dark, in forest. You can never quite tell. I was talking to some scouts. They said we'd never quite tell where the camps are after they leave, because they're just very good at just hiding. So in many ways, the key here is that while sophisticated technology, like from the skies, whatever, is important, when it comes to the LRA, human intelligence is key. And human intelligence has always been there, be it the Mbororo pastoralists, this group that moved from Niger and Chad into Congo, etc., who are in a forced cohabitation with the LRA. They use the same pass, they operate in the forest, or be it local hunters, be it Sudanese poachers, what have you. This is where the information comes from, and this is the key information. A Ugandan officer was telling me that he had seen satellite imagery that the U.S. is providing, and he said it looks all like trees to me. You know, I don't know. I haven't seen them myself. So the problem is, I don't know what the plans are. I think a U.S. official in Kampala mentioned something about unmanned or at least hinted at the possibility of manned or unmanned aircraft. I am worried that if there's going to be a plan about attack from the skies in terms of like a drone or missile or whatever. I would, if that's going to happen, if that's a possibility, I'm not sure if it is, and I certainly hope it's not. I would certainly caution against that, precisely because the risk of collateral damage is huge. LRA, as I said, cohabitates in the forests of the CAR, particularly in Ombomo, with a lot of people, local hunters, I said, Mbororo, etc. The second sort of concern about the UPDF is also that, or rather the advisors, is the lack of mobility in certain areas. So, for instance, UPDF is not allowed to enter Congo. I've been told maybe this has changed recently, but they're not allowed to enter because Congo, for political reasons, Kinshasa says that there is no LRA, and therefore there is no need for the UPDF. All these attacks, they attribute to bandits. So they have a huge problem with banditism, it seems. There is history at play here, you know, UPDF looting of resources in early 2000, so it's kind of hard to also be very, very righteous about having the Ugandans go back into Congo. So I understand why this is happening. And most importantly, LRA and LRA groups, particularly Kony, it seems, have been able to move into northern and southern Darfur in the past. So what happens if that's happening already? Or what do we do if Kony is already in Darfur, or southern Darfur, or northern Sudan? Unless the UPDF and the American advisors are willing to sort of are prepared to sort of open to risk conflict with Sudan, then they are not able to go there. So what happens in the scenarios where you cannot get into Congo and you cannot get into Darfur? And there isn't much time left, I think. First of all, in terms of like the rainy season in the areas in CAR starts, I think, in May. In July, May and July, and August is like, and July and August, sorry, are the wettest months. So it's very hard to move in the bush. You have the elephant grass that is insane, and you cannot just go through we cannot move very easily. So in terms of sort of practical concerns, we have a window until July or so to do something about the LRA, although one can always hope that Kony will just have an accident, something, syphilis, I don't know. And also somebody mentioned, I'm not an expert, obviously, but there is also a political scene to consider here with elections in November this year, I don't know if there's going to be any pressure on the administration to have troops come home, particularly in the light of Iraq and Afghanistan, or whether they can stay like the Philippines, where the advisor can stay there for an indefinite amount of time, 5-10 years, as long as it takes. And this brings us to the point of sort of the exit strategy. Is there a time frame in place? What happens if in 6 months from now the U.S. advisors have to leave, the UPDF is still there but less interested precisely because the Americans are not around anymore? And what happens with the local population? What happens if the LRA is still left to its own devices? We know what happens. They will get reorganized, abduct more, get more people. So we'll get back to square one. And I have quickly now, even though I have my two-minute warning 5 minutes ago, I have some concerns about these unquestioned assumptions. Like, I always sort of read certain sort of statements about the LRA that I think are at least debatable, and certainly not, and certainly should be questioned. So this idea that the LRA is a ragtag group led by a madman, that is not, I don't think that is true. Having looked at the organization, having studied for a while, the amount of discipline in the LRA, it's amazing. They operate as an army with the characteristics of a religious group, for lack of a better word, I don't want to say cult, because they're not a cult. So you have in many ways a very hard to beat soldier, somebody who is fully radicalized, thinks in the ideology, even if the ideology we might not necessarily agree with, and you have somebody who is well-trained, is well-disciplined, and believes in the cause. And this is obviously one of the reasons why the UPDF has not been able to deal with them, precisely because they are not ragtag, precisely because they are well-trained and disciplined. So, but this idea of, oh, they're this crazy guy from the north that has been perpetuated, I think, by Kampala for political reasons, has led to an underestimation of the group, which in effect has had all this perverse, all this deleterious effects. LRA is still around. And I know this point is contentious, but I still want to make it because I think it's cool. the peace talks with LRA will never work because of the Juba talks. I like to disagree. Not that the peace talks with LRA will work, but I think that sentence right there, it needs to be further questioned or further probed into. Because first of all, the autopsy of the Juba talks has not been done properly yet. We don't really know what happened exactly. We don't know what went wrong. We don't know who the spoilers were in the peace process. And it doesn't necessarily mean that all peace processes with the LRA have to be Juba-like. These mammoth talks where everybody was involved, everybody was getting their per diems. I missed out on that, unfortunately. We could talk about smaller deals, involve the northern Uganda, particularly the clergy, people who know who they're dealing with. And it doesn't have to be peace talks with Kony. It can be reaching out to particular groups in Congo that have had no contact with Kony for a while you continue with the other stuff, with the military stuff, particularly if you consider the exit strategy. The other one is killing Kony will destroy the LRA. I don't think so. I don't think, as I make this point sometimes, I made it in the past, as far as we know, Kony could be dead already. It's just hard to know. You know, there are people pretend to be him. His brother looks like him. People say Kony is still there, but everybody in the area says that I'm Kony when they abduct young people just to scare them, to impress them, whatnot. At least as far as the Congo groups are concerned, they operated without Kony for a while. I don't know why they did that. As far as they're concerned, Kony could have been dead. So certainly killing Kony would create chaos in the LRA. It would certainly be a very good step and damage the LRA greatly. I'm not necessarily sure they will disintegrate them completely. And maybe I'll be wrong. And also this idea that only a military option will finish off the LRA. Again, for the very simple reason that you cannot kill them all. It's not possible. You can have 50,000 troops. We're talking about sizes of the largest U.S. states. My geography is not very good. I don't know, California, somebody was saying. You cannot kill them. It's just not possible. You'll still have 3 or 4 groups operating, killing people. And again, go back to the point, as long as they survive, they succeed. And finally, my biggest concern, again, we'll have to go back to the UPDF. Having spent 2.5 years in Kampala and being married to someone who has actually looked into great detail into like sort of human rights abuses of the Ugandan army, it's very hard not to talk about the UPDF, or rather it's very hard to consider them to be the modern army that we all wish they were, and they're just not. And some of the concerns that I have have to do with the fact that UPDF is the best military to do this. They're not perfect, but better than the rest. I'm not sure that actually makes sense to me necessarily. Yes, they might be able to kill LRA, but I'm not so sure they make them a good military or a modern military. There are some serious concerns about UPDF individual behavior in CAR and South Sudan, particularly given the past in Congo in the early 2000s. I'm done, one second. But most importantly, what I'm very concerned about is the excessive use of force against unarmed demonstrators in Uganda. I was in Uganda, in Kampala, in the so-called Kabaka riots in September 2009. 40 people at least were killed, shot, some of them shot in the back, unarmed protesters by Ugandan military, particularly by the so-called the feared red tops, the military police. And then in May 2011, while the world, I think, was when the royal wedding or something was happening. We were the people were getting killed in Kampala on this walk to war campaigns. About six people in Kampala, if I'm not mistaken, a 2-year-old in Masaka, and two people in Gulu, as well, completely unarmed demonstrators. And worryingly enough, the Gulu troops were only definitely UPDF, and they came from the 4th Military Division, which is the main feeder for LRA groups, LRA offensive units, or at least was in the past. There's been an investigation to identify the perpetrators. Nothing has been done. And I want to finish with this. Clearly, there is no comparison to the LRA, UPDF, and LRA. However, if we're going to go after the LRA, if the point of us saying the LRA are bad guys for killing unarmed civilians, I think we should at least hold the UPDF to the same standard. That's it.
Thanks very much, Lelio. Very comprehensive discussion. It leads us on to Joel, and the last points about Uganda follow on nicely into your comments, I think. Joel, thanks.
Well, I echo what Lelio said at the outset. Thank you all for coming. I think this is a much larger attendance than we expected, but is perhaps symptomatic of what I regard as the problem that you will hear as I proceed. My focus is not primarily going to be on the LRA because Lelio and Ambassador Wyckoff really are the specialists here. Rather, I want to talk primarily about U.S. engagement with Uganda because it is within that broader context that the pursuit of the LRA unfolds. And unless there is a healthy relationship and particularly long-term peace and security and development in Uganda, it seems that the pursuit of the LRA will ultimately fail. So my purpose, therefore, is to address a parallel yet often forgotten relationship, mainly the relationship between Uganda and the United States, and more broadly, the relationship between Uganda and the international donor community on which Uganda is dependent. While the U.S. engagement with Uganda to defeat the LRA has attracted considerable attention in this town, many of you would not be here otherwise, and more broadly among civil society organizations obsessed with defeating the LRA, the broader U.S.-Uganda relationship, and more particularly the decline of good governance in Uganda, has been sadly ignored. Compare, for example, two recent op-eds in the Washington Post by Michael Gerson, supporting the sending of U.S. special forces to Uganda, with the near total absence of any coverage given to last year's flawed presidential elections in Uganda, the human rights abuses that followed the elections, with the right to work, walk to work campaign that Lelio just mentioned, and more generally, the decline in social service delivery in Uganda, particularly in the areas of health and education, which arguably may be causing more deaths in that country, or for that matter in the region, than the LRA is causing now. Rising corruption within the regime, a process that has been ongoing for approximately 10 years, but is being exacerbated now as a result of the discovery of oil in Uganda. Rising inflation, and the decline of what had been a sound macroeconomic policy, decline of the Uganda shilling by approximately 20%, repression of anti-regime protests by members of Uganda's civil society during the second and third quarters of 2011. almost none of this is covered in the U.S. press, except sporadically. My argument today is fairly straightforward and simple, and that is that the lens through which Washington views Uganda misses the forest for the trees. And I'd go further, perhaps to be a bit provocative, that U.S. civil society activists are in part the cause of this, however well-intentioned their activities might be. To start with the LRA, barbaric as their crimes have been, Joseph Kony and his dwindling band are no longer a threat to the peace and stability or future development of Uganda, and have not been a threat for roughly 3 years. Peace has returned to northern Uganda for the first time in two decades. The IDP camps have largely been closed. Their former residents have returned to their homes. Yet the north, which we must remember, is populated by a series of ethnic groups, particularly in the area of former LRA activity, the Acholi, who are culturally and linguistically distinct from the residents in the south and who have been on the other side of a longstanding political fault line in Uganda that goes back to the time of independence. The north remains desperately poor, and not fully integrated, particularly politically, into the Uganda's national political economy. Infrastructure continues to be poor, and perhaps most troubling, you now see land disputes in the area as a result of people returning to their former homes, and others have claimed their land, and a vacuum in leadership at the local level because former traditional leaders and other low-level officials were chased out during the period of LRA activity. It's not a very good situation. In short, both regionally, that is, within the north, and nationally, the basic challenges that face Uganda is not Kony, but governance and declining governance. Indeed, the Uganda government's failure to capture Kony to date after 25 years of trying, and indeed the main reason why it took so long for the UPDF to drive Kony out of Uganda, was because of poor governance. Specifically, high levels of corruption within the UPDF, ghost soldiers, procurement issues, payroll problems, etc., some of which has improved significantly. One must give the Ugandans credit in that regard, but nonetheless, problems within the UPDF that certainly compromised the ability of the army to defeat Kony earlier. Moreover, and a point that Letio did not make but alluded to, is that the UPDF plays a key role in maintaining the regime of Yoweri Museveni. This is increasingly a military regime, and has been from the start. And to his credit, Museveni has been very candid about it. In a visit some years ago here to Washington, he was asked by Princeton Lyman, our current special envoy to Southern Sudan, at a Council on Foreign Relations meeting, what is your basis of governance, President Museveni? And the answer was, I have read Max Weber, which to me was rather interesting as an academic, and I make sure that I have a monopoly of force. The UPDF is not a conventional army. It is a political instrument. Half the 55,000 members of the UPDF, and keep that figure in mind, given that only about 1,000 are deployed to pursuit of the LRA, half the 55 members of the UPDF are members of special forces, and a large number of those are members of a Presidential Guard Brigade, a Praetorian Guard headed by the President's son, which has one purpose, and that is not to defend Uganda against normal security threats, but to keep the President in power. Moreover, the continuing presence of CONI and the LRA in Uganda during the first 20 years of NRM rule served Museveni's purposes with respect to consolidating the political support of his regime in the south, where two-thirds of the population lie, particularly among the Baganda, the largest ethnic group in the country and a group which had historical grievances with former rulers of Uganda who hailed from the north. For nearly 20 years, Uganda was hailed by the international community as one of the success stories of Africa and a harbinger of what was possible on the continent. Susan Rice, when she was Assistant Secretary of State, and Bill Clinton referred to Museveni, along with Melis Zenawi and Paul Kagame, as one of the new leaders of Africa. And so it was, and I emphasize was. As those who are old enough to remember, Museveni and the National Resistance Army took power in 1986 after overthrowing remnants of the second presidency of Milton Obote, a northerner who ruled Uganda from its independence in 1962 to 1961 and again from 1981 to 1985. In between, Uganda endured the capricious and brutal rule of Idi Amin, a period during which upwards of an estimated 90 to 100,000 Ugandans died. Another estimated 90,000 are said to have died during Obote's second presidency. The second Obote presidency was as brutal as the Amin period. Fear gripped the country. The economy was in shambles. The population retreated into subsistence. It is against this benchmark that Yoweri Museveni's first 15 years in power were indeed a resounding success, that is to say, from 1986 to 2001. He reestablished peace and security, except in the northern Acholi areas where the LRA was a factor. He adopted sound macroeconomic policies, thanks to the tutelage of his then permanent secretary of the Ministry of Finance and now governor of the Central Bank, Tumusiime Mutebile, that resulted in a stabilization of the Ugandan economy, a turnaround, and high economic growth rates, and most importantly, the regime became favored by the international donor community, particularly the World Bank. Uganda, in contrast to Kenya next door, received debt relief under the HIPC debt relief plan. Growth rates averaged between 9 and 10% a year, although one must recall that those high percentages were in part because they were calculated against a very low base. There was a new constitution in 1995 drawn up by a constituent assembly, which arguably was and remains an excellent document as a blueprint for governance in Uganda, and which included a limit on two elected presidential terms, one of the most effective ways to block corruption and neo-patrimonial or big man rule governance in Africa. The 1996 elections in Uganda were free and fair, among the best of the continent at the time. The judiciary had a high measure of integrity compared, say, to the country next door, in this case, Kenya. There was an emerging parliament that began to flex its muscles and be a serious institution of countervailing power. In other words, all seemed to be going well in terms of Uganda's moving ahead on both the economic front on the one hand and establishing democratic and accountable governance on the other. Sadly, it was all too good to be true, or perhaps more appropriate, all too good to last. Yet the world, particularly the United States and the United Kingdom, have been slow to wake up to the realities in Uganda. And once we have been slow and reluctant to act or push the wrong buttons, such as this dispatching of the 100 special forces to chase CONI. A chase that, for reasons that Ledio mentioned, may not succeed. Indeed, just yesterday, the U.S. Director of Special Operations for the region, Admiral Brian Losey, indicated that catching Kony was, in fact, very difficult because of the terrain. As we've heard, he moves about. This has not bin Laden in a fixed position who can be observed from the sky. But to get back to the governance situation, the high watermark of the Museveni regime, which is now in his 26th year, and he in his fourth elective term, was in 2001. Since then, I would argue, and others I think now agree, that it has all been downhill. It has been a slow and steady decline on the governance dimension generally, but more specifically in respect to the provision of social service delivery, a key element on which the future of any regime depends. It is now said that half of the children in primary schools in Uganda must seek it in the private sector in order to have their kids educated, and that the same is true if you go to a health clinic in Uganda, that one must go to the private sector because if you go to a government health clinic, either people are not going to be there or they're going to be asked for a payoff in order to get these basic delivery of services. At the same time, Museveni has clamped down, as we've heard, on human rights. There's been a rising level of repression, but perhaps most important, he's interfered with key political institutions such as Parliament and the judiciary, although the judiciary still manages to hang on. The two elections that were held in 2006 and 2011 were arguably flawed, though for very different reasons. In the first, his main opponent was locked up and charged in two different courts, a military tribunal on the one hand and a civilian tribunal on the other. In the most recent election, repressive means were not used, but the government basically printed money to win the election. The election was bought. Widely reported in the Uganda press, the president photographed handing out large sums of money to voters and public officials and others. And the main point is, in terms of understanding Uganda, as not only do the military play a key role in the regime, but this is a classic regime of big man rule. It relies on patronage, and it increasingly relies on the granting of liberties to senior officials to loot. And I'm speaking specifically now to the disgraced foreign minister who has stepped aside, but not quite, Sam Kutesa and others, because of their actions in terms of the holding of the Commonwealth Heads of State meeting a couple of years ago. This is a regime that is basically slowly collapsing from within. Will it maintain itself in power in the foreseeable future? Yes, but in terms of a long-term bet in respect to providing peace and security in Uganda, a country that held out such great promise for a while, those days are over. What should the United States do in this regard? My own view is that we need to stop being silent and speak up much more in terms of our public diplomacy, although I recognize there's a clear limit on that. We should support the actions by the World Bank and the UK to reduce budget support, which they have done, and to keep that tap off, because budget support is basically a flow of cash that lubricates a regime of big man rule. And finally, two final points. We need to step up the pressure on Museveni to see that this is his last elected term, because if he tries for a fifth, there is most likely going to be pushback for the simple reason that there are now a younger generation of political aspirants emerging in the Uganda political scene. And lastly, the oil sector, which I really haven't addressed and which we can take up in the Q&A, the oil will not become commercially viable unless it can be essentially transported to the Indian Ocean coast unless Uganda's aspirations are scaled down in the short term and the market is sought for only locally refined products in the Uganda and Eastern Congo region. That pipeline is going to be extraordinarily expensive because it has to be heated and above ground. It will require external financing, probably from the World Bank, and the mistake that was made in respect to financing the pipeline in Chad, even though the World Bank tried very diligently to establish the financing and construction of that infrastructure in a manner that would lead to transparency with respect to the oil in that country, it failed. And we need to really turn up the pressure on Museveni in respect to coming around and having a more transparent extractive industry sector, which right now is not the case. I think I've taken up my time, and I will stop there. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Joel. I'll pass on to Ambassador Wyckoff.
All right. Thank you. Please call me Carl. I just add my thanks for everyone showing up this morning and also for to CSIS for this opportunity. I do have prepared remarks, which I'll go through, and then I look forward to your comments and further discussion of the variety of issues that have been raised and if I can answer any questions. I'm here, of course, to speak about our ongoing efforts to help the people and governments of Central Africa to end the scourge of the Lord's Resistance Army. As we all know, the LRA has been committing horrific atrocities in uprooting communities for some 26 years. Ending the LRA's terror and helping communities to recover from the devastating impact will not be done overnight. It will take time and continued persistence. We greatly appreciate the continued efforts of NGOs, civil societies, private foundations, and ordinary citizens to help in this struggle. A future free of the LRA is possible, and the United States believes it is in our interest to help our partners in the region realize that future. Let me first stress two things before I provide an update on our current efforts. First, the U.S. is working to pursue a long-term, comprehensive, multifaceted strategy and our support to the region. Our military support is one part of a broader effort that includes civilian approaches to encourage defections from the LRA, protect civilians, and support affected communities. Second, this is a multilateral effort. We're working closely with multilateral partners, the African Union, the European Union, the United Nations, as well as the four countries involved, to help the region end the LRA threat. Over recent years, the militaries of Uganda, Central African Republic, and the DRC, and South Sudan have undertaken efforts to pursue top LRA commanders and protect local populations. Each of these countries, especially Uganda, has dedicated significant human and material resources to carry out these efforts. We applaud their commitment, and we have sought to support their efforts. Since 2008, we have provided logistical support to help the Ugandan military sustain its forward operations against the LRA. We continue to fund airlift, fuel, and other transport support for its troops. In the DRC, we trained and equipped a Congolese battalion that's now operating in the LRA-affected areas of the DRC and working with the UN peacekeeping mission there called MONUSCO. MONUSCO and the Congolese military recently carried out a joint operation to deter the LRA from committing massacres in the DRC during the Christmas season, as it had done in 08 and 09. We are receiving positive reports about the performance of the U.S.-trained DRC battalion, the light infantry battalion, and we continue to have two mentors from the U.S. government, funded by the U.S. government, who are working with this unit to support its operations. In the CAR and South Sudan, we're also providing some support to the military forces as they increase their counter-LRA efforts. With our support, these four military forces continue to make some progress in reducing the LRA's numbers and keeping them from regrouping. We believe it is critical that the militaries in the region continue to work together to keep the pressures on the LRA and protect their citizens. As we've seen in the past, the LRA will exploit any reduction in military or diplomatic pressure to regroup and rebuild their forces. In addition to this support, we're working to enhance the capacity of these militaries to accomplish their mission. In October, as you know, the President reported to Congress that he'd authorized a small number of U.S. forces to deploy to the LRA-affected region to serve as advisors to the military forces pursuing the LRA. Small teams of U.S. military advisors are now working with the Ugandan military and national military forces in field locations in LRA-affected areas. In these locations, the advisors are building relationships with military officials and local authorities, promoting information sharing, and helping with training and operational planning. In the DRC, U.S. personnel are working with the Congolese military and MONUSCO at the Joint Intelligence and Operations Center in Dungu. They're helping these forces to plan their joint operations, including the recent operation that I mentioned to prevent large-scale attacks during the Christmas season. Our advisors are placing an emphasis on civilian protection and coordinating closely with the UN missions in the region. We're also working with the African Union as it stands up its regional cooperation initiative. We believe the AU can play a critical role in strengthening the collaboration of the affected states in the fight against the LRA. We welcome the AU's growing engagement. At the same time, as I mentioned earlier, we're not just pursuing military approaches. Military efforts to counter the LRA constitute only one part of a broader strategy and must be nested within a program of civilian efforts. We're working on programs to increase the ability of affected communities to gain and share information about the LRA. NGOs and civil society organizations have done impressive work in this area, and we're working to partner with them and support and expand their efforts. I would like to highlight our deep appreciation for the work, often under very difficult conditions, that a variety of NGO and civil society organizations undertake to help this region mitigate the LRA's threat to human security. In the DRC, we're funding projects to help some remote communities in LRA-affected areas develop community-based protection plans and connect with other communities through a high-frequency radio network and the installation of four cell phone towers. In CAR, we're funding a new project to establish a community radio correspondence network, which will increase the availability of more accurate information on the LRA for local communities. In the last several months, scores of people have defected, escaped, or been released from the LRA's ranks. This is a welcome development. With our encouragement, the UN is undertaking enhanced efforts to ensure that these individuals are taken care of and given the necessary support for repatriation and reintegration. The UN and others are also increasing efforts through leaflets and radio broadcasts to encourage LRA members to defect and return home. We believe these efforts are a critical part of our long-term strategy. One of the sad realities of this situation is that many of the perpetrators of atrocities are victims themselves, abducted in their childhood and forced to fight. We continue to call on more persons to leave the ranks of the LRA, and we continue to work closely with partner countries to provide for the safety of all such persons. According to the UN, there were some 278 LRA attacks, and over 300 abductions during 2011. The number of attacks and abductions appear to have decreased significantly in the second half of 2011. However, we are mindful that this does not necessarily mean the LRA's capacity to wreak havoc has diminished. The LRA continues to cast a wide shadow across the region because of its brutality and the fear it arouses in local populations. According to UN statistics, more than 465,000 people were displaced or living as refugees in 2011 as a result of the LRA threat. We look forward to the day when LRA-affected areas will no longer need humanitarian assistance and can instead focus on development. In northern Uganda, where the LRA ravaged for two decades, that process has begun. With the LRA's departure, northern Uganda has undergone a transformation in just a few years. 95% of the people who once lived in displacement camps have gone home to start rebuilding their lives. The United States is continuing to provide significant support, approximately $102 million in fiscal year 2011, to help the people of northern Uganda, including many former LRA abductees, to rebuild their lives and communities. Our support for northern Uganda's recovery is part of our broader assistance to help Uganda address its most pressing challenges. We have a strong relationship with the people and government of Uganda, and we continue to work closely with them on a range of shared objectives, such as improving the quality and availability of health care, increasing agricultural production, nutrition, and food security, strengthening democratic institutions, promoting accountable governance, reinforcing respect for human rights, and advancing stability in Somalia, South Sudan, and across the region. Our security cooperation with Uganda does not mean we turn a blind eye to Uganda's domestic situation. On the contrary, the breadth of our engagement with Uganda enables candid conversations about our areas of disagreement. We never hesitate to voice concern about efforts to restrict fundamental freedoms or the rights of opposition or minority groups. For example, in recent months, we've made very clear, both publicly and privately, our concern about the human rights situation in Uganda. We continue to urge the Ugandan government to protect the rights of all of its citizens and to lay the groundwork for a more democratic system of government. It is Ugandans that will ultimately determine Uganda's future, and Africans who will determine Africa's future, but the U.S. is committed to being a steadfast partner as they stand up and work to secure a peaceful and prosperous future, whether in ending the LRA's reign of terror, developing responsible security forces, or strengthening democratic institutions. Thank you. Look forward to your comments and questions.
Thank you very much. We've got 15 or 20 minutes for questions. Please raise your hands, introduce yourselves when the microphone comes to you. While you're thinking about your questions, I'll fire off the first one. And it seems like the issue of regional coordination is really critical here. But as Ledio pointed out, the only country where the place where the most active LRA activity is taking place right now in DRC, they've not exactly been keen for the UPDF to operate there, and the US doesn't exactly have much leverage over Congo right now as well. So I'd be interested in your assessments on the kind of political will in each of the four countries involved in this operation. Where does the LRA fit in their overall security strategy? While you think about that, I'll take a couple more questions if I can as well. And let's start with the gentleman at the front here.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Ed Barber from Good Works International. I was intrigued by this discussion on several counts. I have heard and read multiple times that the LRA long ago lost its whatever ideological or overriding political objectives it had, and that variously it's just a terrorist group or something they're fighting because they're used to it. So my question is, why the LRA? You spoke, Mr. Kakaj, if I pronounce it right, you spoke of this, the core group being disciplined, trained, and committed. But committed to what? What are they fighting for? Are they trying to carve out a separate area in northern Uganda, or are they just trying to make themselves richer? A related question, probably for Carl. What is the overriding purpose of our help in northern Uganda? Are we supporting a military effort against the LRA because these are just bad guys that are keeping a whole region poor and undeveloped? Or do we have some strategic concern that they might link up with Al-Shabaab or Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or some wider terrorist group? Thanks.
Mulugeta Katama from Transhorn Group. Question I have is, I'm sure the LRA gets some sort of external assistance. Now, where is that coming from? And secondly, nowadays, it's not the World Bank that's playing a major role in Africa, it's China. And that's the money is coming from. China is the kind of country, like you all know better than I do, that they don't care what goes on, as long as they get what they want, they just pour money in. So isn't it also wise to engage China, especially the State Department, to kind of prevent or try to end these kind of incidents, not only in Uganda, but you know, throughout Africa? That's the question I have.
Okay, great. Well, there's an interesting set of questions. Let's take those for starters, and we'll come back for more afterwards. Who would like to kick off, Ambassador?
You're calling me Ambassador again, Carl.
Sorry,
Carl. You're looking at me, so I'm delighted to kick off. I think I touched just lightly on the political will question for the four countries involved. I just highlight that all of these countries have a variety of challenges. challenges for Uganda have been elucidated on very nicely. A lot of issues that these countries have to deal with, both domestically in terms of their capacity, their governance style, and then their militaries also have a variety of challenges. What I would say is that within that milieu of their situation, all four countries, as I mentioned in my statement, have in fact fielded forces to try to exercise their own responsibility to protect their civilian populations and to the extent that they're able to pursue the LRA. And so from the kind of the political will standpoint, we certainly are in touch with these governments. We would never send any of our forces anywhere where we did not have complete consent and agreement by the countries. For instance, in terms of regional coordination, we're in touch with all of these countries, with the Africa Union, the United Nations, as an advocate for enhanced regional cooperation, sharing of information. And this deployment partially is designed to help that process across borders on the military component to it. But as I mentioned, the defectors piece, those who are able to escape the LRA or come out in some fashion, very key how they're handled. And there's very good work being done by a number of non-governmental organizations, civil society organizations, UN, UNICEF, of course, has a project that I think has made a difference in the lives of hundreds of youth that have come out and is able to help them cross borders, which is one of the difficulties because you have different legal frameworks, different approaches to how these defectors and former abductees are handled. And so we see that as part of our function also is to encourage the AU, the UN, and the countries themselves to work together in a coherent fashion that addresses that basket of civilian issues, for instance. Thank you.
I'll make my comments simply with respect to Uganda and on the question of political will. With respect to the defeat of the LRA, I go so far as to say that the main concern for Uganda is essentially to keep the LRA out of Uganda, that they're not particularly concerned about what they do outside of Uganda's borders, and that the prime security concern of Uganda at the present is really southern Sudan. They also have a large contingent of troops in Somalia, some 6,000, perhaps being raised to 8. You may have the figures, precise figures on that. When I was last in Uganda, the head of military intelligence basically said, look, we're pulling people out of there and reducing to the figure that Letio quoted of approximately 1,000 to 1,200 of our troops, because our prime security threat is elsewhere. And finally, I'll come back to a point that I made in passing in my presentation, and this is it perhaps sounds cynical on my part, but I'd rather say it's cynical on President Museveni's part. The continued specter of the LRA serves his political interests in terms of continuing to maintain political support across southern Uganda. And in the last election, however, there was a significant turning point between the 2006 and 2011 elections in that once the LRA were finally removed from Uganda, he actually won those areas in the north which he had never won before. So the situation and his political calculations have changed a bit. But as I said, the main objective is to keep the LRA outside of the country and deal with other threats.
I'll quickly answer a couple of questions related. One was the political prioritization of the LRA and sort of connect that to this idea of regional cooperation. And then the second, I'll talk about the ideology, which is something that obviously I've looked into quite a bit. In terms of priorities of the LRA, I think what's interesting about the LRA is considered to be this small group, insignificant, but it's always somehow related to a bigger issue, a bigger security issue, be it the cooperation between LRA and Sudan in the past and how it has been used against Sudan, southern Sudan, or more recently this idea that AU is going to come and save us and with that there will be a lot of money. And Joel mentioned a little bit about Uganda, and while I think the LRA is not as
bigger priority than it used to be. President Museveni has to worry about a huge disarmament campaign in Karamoja, obviously Somalia, ADF based in the Congo. The LRA is still connected to Uganda in the sense that it has been explicitly used for political gain during the election of 2011. Army commanders, as well as NRM cadres, were going around saying, if you don't vote for Museveni but vote for the FDC, i.e. the opposition party, the LRA is going to come back. And a lot of people voted precisely for that reason of saying Museveni is now, the LRA is not here, and as a result will vote for Museveni. And traditionally has been a region that has opposed Museveni. In terms of Congo, it's an issue, as far as I understand, of the LRA being very far away. Obviously, as we know, Congo had a very troubled time of elections, as well as dealing with bigger groups, the FDLR in the south. But the history plays a role where Kabila does not want to be seen as weak and allow the Ugandans to enter again some of the same areas they exploited in the past. So as far as I understand, again, not an expert on the issue, he has wanted to, Kinshasa has pushed back on Uganda, on Ugandan troops being in Congo, which is why, as far as I know at the moment, Ugandans are not allowed to enter Congo or are not allowed. Certainly some commanders are making threats to Ugandan army officers saying you're not allowed to be here. And that questions, or rather, I guess, doesn't support necessarily this issue of regional cooperation. I don't think there has been such a thing as regional cooperation, practically speaking. Yes, there's been lip service paid. Yes, the SPLA will be there in FACA and FRDC. The problem is that when it comes to cooperating together, some countries lack willingness, some countries lack resources. FACA, for instance, I was in Bangui. CAR troubles me as a country. I think the government there becoming more and more of a bit of a phantom state. There is no security concern. There are no security concerns when it comes to the southeastern CAR, different about the north, particularly the border with Chad. But again, the LRA is connected. It gains a bit more importance because precisely officials in Bangui expect and hope that both the U.S. as well as the African Union mission forthcoming will help with building the capacity of the FACA that doesn't necessarily have to do anything with the LRA. So that in terms of priorities. And again, South Sudan, LRA doesn't really rank close, even close to what's important. However, there has been an effort to try and link the LRA to Khartoum, as with every other security issue in South Sudan at the moment. So again, there is some interest, but only as relates to a bigger concern. And finally, the ideology. I think the ideology that the LRA fighters still have, might have become practically untenable. Doesn't necessarily mean that he went away. And the ideology has its roots in some of the issues that obviously Joel brought up. The sort of the abuses of the Uganda army or rather Museveni's forces right after the Okello government was defeated by Museveni. If you talk to people in northern Uganda, they still remember very clearly some of the human rights abuses committed by the soldiers at the time, of course, the liberators or other the rebels. And Kony has used that very, very cleverly. He has used this idea that we, as Acholi, were wronged, we were in power. Actually, it was right after Obote, who was Langi, it was actually Okello, who was Acholi. And then for the first time after all the northerners were in power, Amin from West Nile and Alango from further south, from Acholi land, this was the power the Acholis were supposed to have, and Museveni betrayed them in the peace talks that he didn't respect. So you meet former LRA combatants. Some of them abducted when they were 11 or 10, you know, in the last 20 years, and they still talk very passionately about the rights of the Acholi, how their mothers were raped or their cattle was stolen by the Karamojong under the Museveni regime. And there are all these grievances that have never really gone away and have never been addressed. One big issue that remains completely unaddressed is that the LRA focus has overshadowed is the fact that there has been no trials for what happened in Uganda in 86, 87 when Museveni troops came over and committed various abuses.
So, just a question on China. Has there been any interaction with China on the LRA issue?
Happy to address that. Excuse me. What I would say is that we have regular dialogue with China. My assistant secretary, Assistant Secretary Carson, was in Beijing not long ago. We've had delegations from Beijing come to the United States. China, clearly a major presence in sub-Saharan Africa. A lot of work to interact with them, to share views, and to see where we can pursue our two sets of agendas. In terms of the LRA, don't have any recollection of a focus with China, but for the region, a significant player and one that we want to continue to work with. I would just talk for a moment about the focus that the U.S. government and that a lot of us have on the LRA. It is not connected to any concern about Al-Qaeda or terrorist groups, other terrorist groups. As many of you know, I'm sure the LRA was designated by the U.S. on the terrorist exclusion list, and Joseph Kony himself was designated as a terrorist of special concern or something along those lines, based purely on their behavior. On their actions in the region, in Uganda, in the region. The LRA, as we all know, continues to commit atrocities. It is a source of human insecurity. It is a potential source for regional insecurity, and the U.S. pursues it on that basis, that it is intrinsically an organization that needs to be removed, eliminated, reduced, so that it's no longer a threat to regional security or human security. Just wanted to touch on the question about external assistance. As has been mentioned up here, there was external assistance to the LRA some years back. I have seen no evidence of external assistance to the LRA at this stage. That would be a deep concern to the U.S. if we saw that. Thank you.
Yeah, just a quick word about China. And getting back to the point I made, and Ledio made it in a different way, about the centrality of the UPDF for the Museveni government. There was a large Chinese military delegation recently in Kampala. Of course, the details were not widely discussed. Perhaps you can shed some light on that. Ambassador Wyckoff, Carl, clearly Museveni is intent on maintaining his armaments. In fact, one of the budget busters was the purchase of over $700 million worth of jet aircraft this past year, something that's questionable in terms of its utility vis-a-vis the LRA. China also has an increasing presence in Uganda in terms of small investors, that is so-called non-traditional investors, small firms setting up in Jinja, clothing industry and the like. They're certainly there and they're welcome. And lastly, and perhaps most significantly, with respect to the oil sector, the Chinese National Overseas Oil Corporation, as expected, has purchased a one-third stake from the exploratory firm Tullow Oil that has been the prime company in the development of the oil industry. So the Chinese are very much there.
Okay, well, we're running short of time, but let's take a couple more questions. Let's take Ambassador Cohen at the front here.
On the Congo, there are all sorts of rogue groups going around. There's the Mai Mai, there's the FDLR, there's an RCD battalion, there's some of the Congo army that are not out of control. And the common denominator seems to be control of resources, diamonds, cassiterite mines, coltan. Has the LRA gotten into that business as well?
Let's take the lady in the middle here.
Ashley Benner from the Enough Project. The Enough Project is very much in support of the advisors' deployment, and we think it's a significant step forward, although we have concerns about the shortcomings of of the regional armies, and ensuring that there's not a repeat of the failed and destructive Operation Lightning Thunder, which was discussed. So this question is for Ambassador Wyckoff, Carl. What is the U.S. doing to ensure that that the current advisor's mission is not a repeat of OLT, to fill the military and intelligence and logistical gaps of the regional armies, to improve the commitment and collaboration of the regional army, of the commitment of the regional armies and collaboration between the armies, and to engage with high and middle-ranking commanders?
Okay, well, we'll round off with those. And perhaps I can just add a little one on the end there. What's the timescale for this U.S. deployment, and how are we going to judge, what benchmarks are we using to judge success or otherwise? Are there any red flags which would cause us to pull out? And with that, I'll hand over to you to make any final comments.
All right, thank you. From Ambassador Cohen, from from the information that that I've got, I don't see any evidence of the LRA being involved in minerals trade or woods trade to a significant degree or really at all. I mean, we don't see it. They operate in such remote areas, generally speaking. They are, you know, they are subject of a very live manhunt by the UPDF and by other regional forces. So don't think that's a factor with the LRA. In terms of the U.S. deployment, I just highlight again that this deployment is part of a much broader strategy, and one that the significant pieces are still being put in place, be it on the protection of civilians through HF radio nets or cell phone towers or helping communities, helping local governments, not civil society organizations. The Catholic Church comes to mind, obviously, in the DRC. Just a number of organizations, of helping them better understand their environment, be able to predict what threats might be coming at them and take what actions they can to protect themselves. So, and then also I mentioned the defectors piece, the abductees piece, and then, of course, the mitigation. We haven't talked at all, and again, civil society organizations very much involved in the mitigation of this, the hundreds of thousands that are displaced. The military piece to this is very much aimed at many of the issues that our NF colleague laid out in terms of, you know, what we saw as some of the gaps, some of the shortfalls in the operations that we were trying to support in recent years, in terms of the ability to gather information, to synthesize that information, fuse it is the term of art in some circles, and to figure out how to operationalize that information, be it on the civilian front in terms of warning or taking actions on defectors or whatnot, on the civilian pieces to this, or on the military side. And so the goal with having this U.S. advised and assist mission is to try to improve all of these four militaries' capabilities to do that, to have that whole operation cycle from the gathering of information, the analysis and fusing of information, and figuring out how best to operationalize that, be it for the protection of civilians, be it for the pursuit of an LRA formation. I would like to recall for the group in the run-up to OLT, the LRA was not quiescent. If I remember right, was it 225 killed in the 10 months before OLT, 700 and something abducted by the LRA are the numbers that I was given at that stage. So the LRA wasn't quiescent. It wasn't trying to find a hole to crawl into and disappear. It was building its ability to operate. It was committing atrocities. And it is very regrettable that it then chose, that the leadership of the LRA then chose this retaliatory stance that they did, the Christmas massacres of 2008. This is a pattern. I mentioned that there have been efforts made. I mentioned the effort in 2011, December of 2011. There was a similar effort in December of 2010 to proactively take measures to prevent that, to prevent a recurrence of that. With that, I think I would leave it. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Just a quick point about the exploitation of mineral resources.
And it's remarkable. I've looked in sort of the history of the LRA for as long as I could have possibly done. I've never found an example of the LRA trying to exploit mineral resources, trying to do exactly what the FDLR and some other Maimai groups in Congo have done, even when it came to bartering those minerals for guns, for weapons. And I think that again points to a sort of the ideological austerity that they have in place, which is that, you know, there is still, it appears, honor among thieves. They're trying to do this for the right reason, even though those reasons might not be right to us or might not be even practically tenable anymore. I'd like to sort of, I guess, conclude with a larger point, I suppose, about the U.S. strategy, which I think in many ways came about as a result of this dedicated push from certain people that made the LRA their sort of their young lives' aim. And in many ways, I think the sort of the LRA's the strategy fell into the administration's lap. Perhaps accidentally, they didn't expect this sort of thing. And as a result, I guess the most straightforward thing to do, not the easiest, the straightforward thing to do was to just adopt the Ugandan policy. In other words, let's do whatever is happening already out there. But that there was not an organic process there in terms of the U.S. itself saying, we tried X, Y, and Z, and now we're going to move on to the next logical step. And I think that's where I think my concern is, that adopting the U.S. the Ugandan strategy means adopting their failures, means adopting their poor judgment on certain issues. And I would love to see more. I've been the one going around and saying there's got to be more things like DDR, demobilization. There's got to be more other ways of looking at the problem. And so far, while there certainly is an interest in doing, there are still the civil society, the NGOs who are doing the other work. The DDR leaflets are designed and put together by our colleagues at Invisible Children. Most of the information comes through their brilliant crisis tracker from Resolve. I'm sure enough offers expertise. So all of these other concerns, all of other issues, apart from just the military aspect, are still only at the moment spearheaded by the NGO community, also the radios as well. So it is perhaps time for the U.S. to try, or the U.S. administration to try, a novel approach to the LRA conflict. And again, I don't want to use the dreaded P word, the peace talks, but something along the lines of a combined approach, DDR, maybe peaceful and reaching out to certain commanders to try and use different ways that perhaps have not been fully tried in the past. And with that, I conclude. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'll be very brief. First, in respect to the LRA into Coltan, the likes. I have no particular knowledge here. I'll take Ledio's assessment. But I would point out that the real culprit in terms of exploiting such resources has been the UPDF. He mentioned the timber, and previous to that in the Congo, which was the subject of several commissions of inquiry in Uganda, involving very senior levels of the army, and again, part of the patronage role that the army plays in supporting the Museveni regime. One aspect that I'm surprised has not been discussed here, and I am not an authority on it, but I'll just mention it in closing, is amnesty. There is an amnesty law, I believe, passed by the Ugandan parliament, and yet, and I know in our conversations, you've had some concerns about the extent to which the government of Uganda has really implemented its own legislation, and your point about who is doing the fighting. On the one hand, arguably, those people know best how to chase the LRA. On the other hand, they're also being exploited. And then finally, the other unanswered question is the exit strategy. For how long do we keep this up, particularly if it doesn't lead to results? And as I suggested in my presentation and in a copy of the CIS report that you have, I think we're missing the forest for the trees.
Thanks. That's the big question. So thank you very much, all of you, Ledio, Joel, Carl. It's been a great conversation. Please join me in thanking our guests.